Australian True Crime, the nation's leading independent true crime podcast, is hitting the road with our live show. We're coming to Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane this July, and tickets will be available starting May 10th at 9:30 a.m. sharp. They sold out in 2 hours last time, so do not dilly-dally. We know the suburbs of Australia are teeming with some of the most intriguing and chilling true crime stories the world has ever heard. Don't miss the chance to dive deeper and get involved with a live Q&A. With over 1.5 million downloads monthly, these tickets will sell out. So keep an eye on our social media pages and check the podcast bio for direct links to purchase yours as soon as they're released on Friday, May 10. I can't wait to see you there.
Hi, it's Amanda.
Hey, Amanda. It's Michelle. How are you?
Hey. Good, thanks, my love. How are you?
Oh, good, thank you. I'm sure you've had a long day at work like I have and a long week and everything. And on top of that, I listened to your podcast last night. Yep. I think it was yesterday, Monsters Who Murder, which I love.
Mm-hmm.
And
thank you.
I find out that you are the insider. You are the family insider who is the person who's been speaking to the media on behalf of the family of one Ivan Milat.
Yes, Robert was pissed off that I had given them all this information and they hadn't named me. I didn't say they couldn't name me. So it was quite surprising to say a source close to the family has said. It's like, whoa, hang on a sec.
Oh, Robert McKnight, that is, the man who you did the podcast with, of course.
Podcast with.
When you was first started saying that, I thought, oh, is that a Milat brother? That's, you know, because normally it's about some sort of drama in the Milat family. Because
there is.
Yeah. Everyone loves to talk about insiders in the family. It's more mysterious and more exciting if everyone makes out that they have some contact, you know, that they have some secret contact in the family, but it's actually you. So tell us what's going on with Ivan, because, of course, our listeners will know that you have been writing to Ivan for 20 years. You're working on a book with Ivan.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I am. So looks like I've got a deadline.
Well, that's one way of putting it. I've read things ranging from he's got senior anorexia.
Mm-hmm.
He's got cancer.
Which he does.
Yeah?
Yes. Okay. Yes, which is... they're claiming he has cancer, but there's actually no official word, and really they can't actually tell us. But his nephew, who I've been in contact with as well, has come out and said that Milat has cancer, but it actually hasn't been confirmed yet. But on top of that, then, they're saying that he also has 2 weeks to live, but people have been told they've had 2 weeks to live and they die the next day or they die in 2 years' time. So really it's just a ticking time bomb to see what happens. At 74 and having spent 25 years in prison, you're still going to be quite elderly, and knowing how much weight he's lost and the aches and pains that he has had all this time, this is certainly not beyond the realms of possibility.
Absolutely. And as you pointed out in your podcast, he has done a number of hunger strikes. So that has affected his health.
Absolutely. I think he went into prison about 110 kilos and now he's down to the mid 60s. So he's lost about half his body weight, which is a significant amount, especially when he was quite lean anyway. So he didn't have fat to lose. So it's played with him quite significantly, and by having geriatric anorexia, it means that organs do shut down and cancers do arise because lumps and bumps start to feed themselves because he wasn't eating.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if you've noticed. I'm sure you've – well, I don't know. I'm not sure, actually. Maybe you've had similar messages to your social media that we've had. We posted – a link when the story first broke a few days ago with the story that Ivan was in hospital and was thought to be quite ill. And, I mean, the messages were all really negative, really along the lines of good, basically. Did you have similar messages to your social media about people wishing him ill?
Yes, I mean, besides the usual, well, they should have shot him in the first place anyway, there's been a lot of information about having him tortured. So rather than saying, you know, he's a human being and he needs to be treated, they're all saying, well, let him die a slow death. And esophageal cancer is actually quite horrific. It's one of the worst cancers to get. And so people are almost gleefully happy that he's dying of such a horrid disease. And it is quite surprising because they go and they read all the articles and they hear our podcasts and then they comment.
Yeah, and I mean, the other thing that's interesting though, and I was just saying this to Emily, like a couple of days ago, just before this story broke, I still get messages on my social media since last time you and I spoke on the podcast, mm-hmm. from people asking me though, what proof I have that Ivan is guilty. Like there is still a really passionate contingent of people who don't believe that Ivan is guilty of the crimes, and they're always very polite. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but they keep popping up.
I don't get them so polite. I get them quite aggressive at me. And yet I'm very much both sides of the fence. There is enough evidence there to suggest his guilt, but there's also a lot of questions that haven't been answered. So I'm in both camps, but I still get a lot of threats from people saying, don't talk about Ivan, he didn't do these crimes. And I've actually spent most of today talking to a lot of TV programs and news outlets about that they're hoping that there is a deathbed confession. And I'm saying 100% there won't be. In fact, he will use his dying breath to say he is innocent of these crimes. And I mean, in the world of psychopaths and sociopaths, that's the final ultimate power, is to take it all with him.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point you've made there. Obviously, Ivan is not the only person that you write to. That's what you're famous for. You're known as the serial killer whisperer because you have been writing to people on death row around the world for a mm-hmm. long time, for 20, 30 years, most of your life. Have you ever mm-hmm. known anyone to make a big deathbed confession?
No, not yet. In fact, it usually goes the other way. And like John Wayne Gacy, who just said, kiss my ass, that's usually how it goes down. But I've been talking to Bobby Jo Long in Florida now for about 20 years, and he's actually being executed next week. Mm. So I correspond with him by email, actually. So I'm waiting to see if I get a final one, because he will go into the watch house to be watched before the execution actually happens. So I'm waiting to see if I get anything final, if there is a confession, if there is an apology, if there's remorse. But I highly doubt. I don't think a lot of them do. We know that Ted Bundy did. Ted Bundy decided to call in all state police and say, hey, what crimes do you have? And I'll basically confess to it. So some do, but they are few and far between.
Yeah, Ted Bundy also offered to help them with profiling, didn't he? With other cases, tried to help them understand the mind of serial killers.
Mm-hmm. A few killers have done that. I had David Burney do that. He wanted to help catch the Claremont serial killer, and he believed that he had a suspect. Obviously, it's now been proven to be wrong. But he was keen to help, saying, you know, use my mind for what you're looking for. But the police didn't seem to want to be involved with him doing that. So the fact that they were interested in Ted Bundy doing that, it's crazy not to. But then, you know, at the same time, people like John Douglas, who is behind Mindhunter, he actually believes that Manson would have been a good profiler because he's able to see people's strengths and weaknesses, and he believes he could have been an asset had he gone the other way.
Actually, yeah, now you're taking me back to the series Mindhunter. Who was that man who that first series is about, who killed his mum?
Ed Kemper. Yeah, that's amazing. The actor did so well in that. But Ed Kemper was one of those, but he was also highly intelligent, and most of them aren't, so they can't sort of keep that passion at bay to be able to look at these things clinically, whereas Kemper could put his own blurred reality aside and actually talk to them about the clinical side of it.
So he was helpful in real life.
Yes, absolutely.
So he was helpful in real life with the FBI in setting up their profiling division?
He was, and because when he had been in juvenile detention, he'd actually worked with a clinical psychologist. So he learned all the ins and outs. So he knew the right terms and knew what they were looking for to answer the questions that were essentially the very start of criminal profiling.
Wow. Okay. So as the, you know, official insider, of the Malat clan, which is a really weird. I mean, how comfortable are you with that title, by the way?
Not at all.
No, it's pretty weird. How's the family holding up? They are a family that's always sort of at odds. There's factions within the family always.
Mm-hmm.
How are they holding up? I heard the other day that he was getting lots of visitors. Is that true? Is that possible?
No, it's not. And no one can actually see him, and they have to go through a whole process to actually get in, and maximum of two people can see him. So the family has to decide who that is going to be. And obviously his nephew hopes it's him. But the family does close ranks a bit.
Do you mean the nephew who wanted to follow in his footsteps and actually murdered a friend in Belanglo Forest?
No. This is the other one.
Different
who wrote
one.
A book with Ivan. Yeah.
Right.
There's
okay.
A few of them.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the family does close ranks a bit when things like this come up. Mm. But there is also a faction in the family that will cheer that he's dead, and they will certainly come out and talk against him and say how vile and horrible he was. Whereas the rest of the family will want to mourn and talk about him as an innocent man.
Wow. Have his letters of recent times suggested that he was, becoming more frail?
Actually, he's been complaining about a sore shoulder for about 18 months. And obviously that is a transference of pain from possibly a stomach cancer. So you can get like a shoulder tip pain when you have stomach issues. So it could be that he has had this for about 18 months but wasn't aware until they've actually done a diagnosis.
Mm. I know we've spoken about this before, about your feelings about these people that you write to, and certainly we spoke about this about David Burney when he took his own life, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what was the situation around that? So this is a man, he and his wife were living in Perth and they killed a number of young women.
Mm-hmm.
And I seem to recall there was some situation involving you before he killed himself.
Yes, well, we'd been going through a few crime scene tapes that I'd been sent by a fellow prisoner there with David in Perth. And it was to look at if they were possibly linked to the Claremont case. And so we were working through that, and the Department of Corrections wasn't happy about that and decided to cut our contact. But around the same time, Burney was also off his antidepressants, which he had been prescribed, purely because the script hadn't come through from the pharmacist, and so he had to wait. And so he'd gone through a bit of a detox of those. So then when he was told, this is your last phone call to her, it kind of was the last straw, because Catherine Burney, his common-law wife, had actually severed ties as well, because she wanted to go through a parole hearing, and she couldn't do that if she was still in contact with him. So all of these things sort of linked together, and he rung me that final night, and I didn't know it was the final time, but apparently he did, and he took his life soon after. And then in the coronial case, it was brought up that I was his only link to the outside world, and by them taking that away from him, he believed he had nothing else to live for. So it's quite a confronting thing to have, but you know, these things happen. So it just sometimes proves that we're all human, and sometimes I'm can see myself as part of the blame, that these people they invest in this relationship that happens, even if it's interviewer and interviewee, and they actually look forward to it. So then when it's been severed, they feel that there's nothing left, because they don't have that break in their mundane life that's, you know, same every single day.
Yeah, and I know for you it's work. It's definitely work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's research. But I also know that situation affected you, because how could it not? And I'm mm-hmm. just wondering about Ivan, when he inevitably dies, how that will affect you, do you think? Will you miss him? Given that you've been writing to this person for 20 years, for better or for worse, mm-hmm. And you've been working on a book with him, you know, do you think about that? Do you think about not writing to him anymore and not receiving letters from him anymore?
It's sort of a weird emotion to have, because you do think, oh, yeah, I'm waiting to get something back from Ivan, or, oh, the last one that's turned up. And even with Bobby Joe Long, who's being executed next week, I've been talking to him for 20 years too. And I'm consciously thinking each day, it's now 6 days, it's now 5 days, that someone I know and have been talking to for so long, they have an end date. Mm. And it's quite confronting to think that regardless of who they are and what they've done, they're still people and they're going to die, and they've been part of my life for so long and part of my research and part of who I am. So there will be a loss. It won't be a grief, but there will definitely be a loss that I will feel that these people that have been part of my life for so long are no longer there. So there's going to be a gap. So my serial killer in Supermax will be gone. My serial killer on death row in Florida will be gone. So they're parts of my puzzle and my research that have an end date, and it's quite confronting to think about that. But at the same time, you know, we can think about that it saves taxpayers, that these people didn't care about the lives that they took. So there is a gratefulness too that they're gone, but you have to still wonder about the butterfly effect that happens from their lives. And, you know, I'm more concerned about the families that finally get that, not closure, but they get to say that there's going to be no more issues of parole hearings.
Can you tell us when you think this book will be released?
Well, I'd actually put it aside last weekend because I'm working on the death museum I've got coming up next month.
Yes.
So it looks like I'm going to have to burn the midnight oil and get it out.
Tell us about the death museum. Yes, I read you mentioned that to me in an email recently, and I thought, what is that? I'm so interested.
I can't believe I hadn't told you.
No.
Well, basically, I had this brilliant idea last year that I have all of this information sitting around, letters from all these different serial killers. I collect ancient artifacts. I have original press photos and negatives from crime scenes of police files that I have. I have all of this information just sitting here collecting dust in my house. And I have a friend who does ghost tours and has a lot of event experience. And I said to her, let's do a death museum. I have a whole lot on O.J. Simpson. I've got a whole lot on the James Bulger murder case in England.
Wow.
I have a lot on the cults. So I have all of these sorts of different sort of aspects of criminal death as well as religious and war and all of this. Just I actually have original newspaper articles on the JFK assassination.
It really is as broad as a museum about death. You know, it's like just different kinds of stories about death, criminal death, different kinds of death.
I've got everything. So whatever people think about, that's what they're going to see. There's some taxidermy. There is some weird and wonderful things like scary dolls and wow, some strange bits and pieces that we have. Basically, anyone that has a morbid interest in history will find something at the museum that they like.
Amanda, you never cease to astound and amaze and fascinate me, and I love it. And I know you still take a ton of shit, if I may say so, from people who don't dig it and don't get it. But I do. I really love it. And I love your podcast, Monsters Who Murder. I love your work. I love everything you do. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Michelle. Talk soon.
Talk soon, babe.
Australian True Crime, the nation's leading independent true crime podcast, is hitting the road with our live show. We're coming to Sydney, Melbourne and Brisbane this July, and tickets will be available starting May 10th at 9:30 a.m. sharp. They sold out in 2 hours last time, so do not dilly-dally. We know the suburbs of Australia are teeming with some of the most intriguing and chilling true crime stories the world has ever heard. Don't miss the chance to dive deeper and get involved with a live Q&A. With over 1.5 million downloads monthly, these tickets will sell out. So keep an eye on our social media pages and check the podcast bio for direct links to purchase yours as soon as they're released on Friday, May 10. I can't wait to see you there.